Welcome to Force Speaks.
Hello and welcome to More Speaks. This is More along with Ray, my co-host.
Yo, yo, what's happening, folks?
All right. So, unfortunately, I do sound great today. Our last interview, I had some technical issues, but we are back in high fidelity surround sound, or however you want to call it, 4K audio. I do sound better. Sorry to Scooby and Ray. They sounded great, but let's get this week started. So today, so me and Ray, we were talking and he kind of wanted to chat about, what was it, a series you saw? What's the name again? Dark Side of the 90s?
That's right. So we had some other plans originally for this week. And last night, my wife and I just happened to put on Hulu and there's a series on there called The Dark Side of the 90s. And, you know, me being from the 90s, I was just kind of curious. I like to see how these documentaries kind of paint the narrative of what was going on during that time, because I know I was there. We were there. And I came across one episode that I just couldn't let go. And so I immediately hit you up and was like, yo, you got to watch this. And here we are.
So just a little backstory about Dark Side of the 90s. I didn't watch them all. I just watched the main one, just to be 100% honest. But on there, if you look back, you know, everything that happened in the 90s, the Beanie Babies, it was some other stuff, rap, hip hop.
Jerry Springer,
Montel. All those shows, you know, how the 90s, you know, came up and, you know, rap and everything. So so the episode we watch basically was a take on the 90s, on how East Coast and West Coast rap came about, how it, you know, kind of molded, you know, the rap industry. What was the magazine? Source got started. And I know Ray had his two cents on it, because the way the magazine started, I mean, it wasn't even, you know, a black person that started it. It actually was, what was it? Two Jewish kids from New Jersey or Philadelphia?
Yeah, it was two Jewish white kids from Jersey, and they were both, they both met at Harvard. And they graduated Harvard, and they went ahead and started the Source magazine together.
Yeah, so they started the magazine. In true honesty, I mean, anyone could have done the magazine, because the way they started was basically just reporting on hip hop and what was going on and who was, you know, to them, I guess, the best rap at that time. But what they did was, they did do something smart. They enlisted, you know, black writers and you know, black folks that were in the industry that kind of knew a little bit about it. What was kind of futuristic or, you know, mind-blowing to me was what they did was they came up with a rating system, which wasn't fair at that time, because they came up with a rating system. It was, you know, five mics all the way down to one mic. And according to, you know, some of the interviewees that they had, like Bill Bellamy, if you had anything below four mics, pretty much you had to, they're basically saying, give up your career.
Yeah. Well, with the mics, that was so, to be fair, and I want to put everything in context, it's not that I have something against the Source or against the Vibe or whatever. I just don't like how the narrative is being painted for the new generation. Because as we know, you know, history is told by the victors, the people that survived, right? So Tupac isn't here to tell the story. Biggie isn't here to tell the story. We can only go back and watch interviews. And so what I feel is with this documentary, by them, when they started talking about the source, it was like, they made it sound like, oh yeah, it all was birthed at the same time. Like hip hop and then the magazine followed. And the next thing you know, the industry bloomed and blew up and all that. And to be fair, I mean, from a business opportunity standpoint, you know, hats off to both of them for starting the source, for seeing an opportunity and capitalizing on it. I think what bothered me was the fact that they wanted to say like it was the culture, you know, like, oh, well, hip hop was always inclusive from the beginning. Like it was always its own thing. And that's just not the case. You know, hip hop wasn't always receptive to outsiders. Hip hop wasn't even really accepted within its own culture, you know, at times, because remember early when hip hop started, it wasn't just, you know, getting in front of a microphone and rapping. It was, you had graffiti artists, you had the break dancers, you had, again, the artists, you had the DJs, you had the MCs. So hip hop was very complex. It was a lot of different influences all in one thing. So for the source to come out and then for them to try to take this credit that I feel they don't deserve, because I know that there were other magazines and local black stories being written by black authors and black writers about hip hop and what was going on and how it was all coming about. So with the 5 mic ranking, you know, 5 being the best, 1 being the worst, I believe they said anything under a 4 or a 3 was like, it's not even worth listening to. And so that's kind of like where we can start kind of nitpicking at what they talked about exactly. So go ahead, Morph.
Yeah, so with the mic rating, before we get into anything else, with the mic rating, they kind of were biased. So since they were an East Coast type magazine, they were biased to any, let's say, East Coast rapper. They would give them higher ratings. I'm from the East Coast. I get it, you know, but when Dr. Dre came out, they gave him that should have been a 5 mic automatic, you know, just by one song, you know, just a chronic, you know, that should have made the whole album a top 5, and it only got 4.5 mics. And then I guess when I think it was Snoop Dogg came out right after that, and they gave him 5 mics just in retrospect, because everybody was like, you should have given, you know, Dr. Dre 5 mics. So that kind of started, you know, like a small rivalry, but it wasn't what started the whole East Coast, West Coast thing. To what Ray was saying, the one of the issues with the Source magazine, you know, I guess, you know, their head kind of got big because people were saying that they were the Bible of hip hop, you know, they're the Bible of rap. And you have to think back to the early beginnings of rap and hip hop, you know, like Ray said, it's not just grabbing a mic and start rapping. You know, you had the beatboxers, you had the breakdancers, you had everyone else, you had, you know, before Run DMC, you know, cause I want to say, they're the pioneers, right? But before Run DMC, you know, came out with Aerosmith, that made them more, you know, nationwide. For that, you know, you had underground rappers for years, way before that.
Well, the thing with Run, okay, so Run DMC, I would say, was basically like the first main hip hop supergroup, right?
Mainstream,
but you know, I think the first hip hop record, and I forget the name at this moment, but it's the I said a hip hop, you know, that was the first real like sound of hip hop, you know, and that was like, that might have been late 70s or maybe mid 70s, and you know, you had artists.
Yeah, you made me forget. You made me forget who they are. So
yeah,
go ahead, keep talking. Let me find it because
yeah, I'm forgetting off the top of my head. But they also got the other one.
The name of the song is Rapper's Delight.
There you go, Rapper's Delight. And so they was out and they were the ones to kind of take that you know groovy
Sugar Hill Gang.
There you go, Sugar Hill Gang. Jesus Christ. A tip of the so Sugar Hill Gang kind of did it first, but then you know you had Slick Rick. I mean,
you had Grandmaster Flash, yeah, Slick Rick. You know, you had the group that Dr. Dre was originally part of. I can't remember who it was.
They had I'm sticking to East Coast just because. Like, we have to give East Coast its due. Like they say, hip hop is always, we've always said that the East Coast is the mecca of hip hop. New York is the mecca. So to be fair, like, these are all just East Coast artists that I'm talking about that was out before Run DMC. But you had Afrika Bambaataa, you had Grandmaster Caz, Grandmaster Flash, you know, Biz Markie, you know, so many iconic artists that were on the street. These guys were throwing huge parties. They were throwing parties at bodegas. They were doing it in Central Park. You know, it started in the streets and in the culture. So for me, the issue I really took was for them to say that the source just came up organically and that it was part of the culture. Like, no, it wasn't. Because as you go along through this episode, they constantly mention suburban white kids. And we have to give, you know, we have to stick to the facts. So were suburban white kids buying hip hop? Were they intrigued? Were they curious? Yes. Was the source probably the only way that they would be able to have all that knowledge and information about the street without being in the street? Yes. Because these are suburban white kids. And if we're talking about the 90s and you know, they had just came off the crack epidemic. Then in the early 90s, we had police riots and you know, stuff going on all over the place. And so these suburban white kids became fascinated with this lifestyle that they hadn't heard of before. You know, if you remember a very popular song by Run DMC, it's called My Adidas. You know what I'm saying? Run DMC, these three guys come out with these nice, flashy black leather jackets with the gold chain, rope chains. And, you know, that stuff is intriguing. People want to, that's cool. That's fresh. That's dope. That's fly. And it was something new. And so while we can't take away credit from the suburban white kids, I think that it's a stretch to say that the source came from the culture. It was accepted by the culture just off rip, you know. And I think that, you know, and I hate to say it this way, but predominantly people of color or people that were labeled minorities at that time, you know, they always said, we don't read. So we actually are sitting here listening to the CDs, to the tapes, to all that versus reading it in a magazine because we live that life every day. So that's kind of the issue that I have is that they want to make it sound like the source just came out organically when these two Harvard graduates made this magazine and made it what it was. They just had great marketing. I feel like it's, you know how we talk about the fourth branch of the government? The fourth branch of the government is the media. And so what is the music industry? Media. It's digital media. It's sonic. It's audio media. So, you know, in order for you to get a movement going, in order for you to get radio play, in order for you to get a slot on MTV to do a music video, that costs money. You know what I'm saying? And these rich white executives or these rich Jewish executives or these rich gay executives or whatever it was, because there's a serious thing in the industry. Like if you really know, there's a big LGBTQ presence in the industry. A lot of people of importance are in those positions of power, whether they be white, black, whatever, it doesn't matter. they're still in that position of power and they push their agendas and they do their things and stuff like that. Sorry for kind of ranting here, but
yeah, so I mean, I understand your point, but also what they were trying to get at is, so like what they were saying is, so like rock and roll, right? Around that time, rock and roll and rap was coming up at the same time. Rock and roll had a lot of mainstream. Well, rock and roll was still already around, but it was becoming more mainstream. And what they're trying to say is, you know, everybody who was listening to rock and roll was people who, you know, white people, pretty much. Not many, you know, people of color, you know, were listening to that. Hispanics, blacks, you know, we listened to it, but we wasn't listening to it to where we would sway and have a whole bunch of, you know, albums and stuff like that. You know, it was here and there. So what they were trying to say is mainstream, you know, rap and hip hop at that time was being bought by, you know, white folks and, you know, people of color, you know, all the minorities. So when they were saying, you know, the white people were buying it and buying the source, I think the reason why the source became as big as it did was because it was at the right place at the right time. It wasn't because they were the best magazine. There was just nothing out there like them. And I can say I've never bought a Source magazine. I have, you know, gotten like some of their CD mixes where they had like a whole bunch of them, because they had just a whole bunch of artists. It was almost like buying the tracks for like a movie. You know, you had just a whole bunch of, you know, good songs all mixed together where you didn't have to, you know, fast forward or anything like that. But I mean, I understand the point, because like you said, it was two Jewish kids that had nothing to do with hip hop. They really didn't know hip hop. They just wanted to report, you know, about hip hop, and they were just at the right place at the right time. You know, there was nothing else out there. Nobody wanted to be honest, nobody even wanted to play any rap or hip hop. Even before NWA, even before Eazy-E, they were not given any type of airplay until there was a few, one of the radio stations became 24/7 hip hop. And then, 94,
something like that.
When Yo MTV Raps came out. And
oh, yeah.
Even that was kind of here and there, because if you remember, if you go back to them times, Yo MTV Raps was on once a week. And once it blew up, you know, then it started to be an everyday show, you know, with the segment, you know. But even now, it's like, who plays videos? Nobody plays videos no more. So it's like, that was like the way, you know, Wu-Tang, you know, Das FX, you know, all these, you know, newer groups at that time were getting some type of airplay, where they probably wouldn't get airplay on the radio anyway, but this is one way that they were getting airplay on, you know, even if they didn't have a video, they would just go do an interview with Dre and
but look, I'm glad you brought that up, because here's kind of why I'm attacking this episode of this documentary so heavily. Again, it's not an attack on the Source or the Vibe. I myself have never bought a Source magazine or a Vibe magazine. So actually, I'm glad you mentioned some of the stuff about how organically hip hop was starting to come out with Yo MTV Raps, and the video. MTV was the biggest thing on earth at that time. So the fact that even hip hop had a little slot, you know, and it's also supply and demand. Like, if you only have something on once a week and everybody's tuning in for that one thing, that one day out the week, you know, you're drawing more and more and more and more people, because they don't have that opportunity to see that anywhere else. But another point is that since hip hop was a movement or culture that started in the streets, eventually, because the industry is, you know, let's just say corporate, right? It's very corporate. You have to merge the streets and the industry somehow to where it makes sense for the industry and it makes sense for the streets, you know, because that's kind of the issue I had with the source. How are these two Jewish white kids from Harvard going to sit here and tell us all about it? They're going to tell us about hip hop when they're not in the streets. And, right. And so talking about people like Wu-Tang, talking about people like Jay-Z, all these early artists. So like, I know stories about where I've watched interviews where Jay-Z and Dame Dash would go to radio stations and just drop a bag of money on the table and walk out. And next thing you know, their songs are being played on the radio. There was no contract. There was no nothing. All it was these dudes put their money where their mouth was. They dropped the bags and they got the stuff done. So, you know, that happened across the board. It wasn't just Jay-Z, you know, if you go back deeper, you know, Tupac was a dancer for Digital Underground. And yep. Then he starts doing freestyles in between the breaks that they take at the concerts and stuff. And next thing you know, he links up with Tretch and from Naughty by Nature and boom. So like these things didn't just happen the way they happen now, where you drop a video on TikTok or YouTube or wherever and it goes viral and then you're in the industry. That's not how it works. Back then it was like you had to give them a reason to sign you because it had to make sense for them, because they weren't going to sit here and just give people of color and minorities that platform and that amount of money if it wasn't going to pay off for them. And so that's how, like, yeah, if we go back and
you basically had to go, to the radio stations and pilot yourself, basically go and like you said, drop some money to get, you know, some type of airplay, you know, and that's how they used to do it. You don't hear that many, not as much as before, radio interviews as before, because before the radio interviews was them trying to get their music played or bring out, hey, I just dropped a single, here it is, go ahead and play it. And they'll play it one time. And if it hits, then they'll start to, you know, put in rotation. That's why that's why XM radio and satellite radio has become so big, because if you would listen to the radio station, you would hear the same songs every hour, you know, because whoever paid the most money was the one that was getting played, you know? So like they may throw like four or five songs, you know, different within an hour, but that same song would come back. You'll hear the same, you know, let's say Dr. Dre was hot at that time. You hear Dr. Dre at the top of the hour, then like an hour and a half later, you hear it again. And then again, you know, throughout the whole day, until the point where people get tired of the song and until they drop another single or someone else, you know, with more money comes up there with something. That's why, you know, people started going to the Pandoras, the Spotifys, to where they can make their own playlist, because playlists on the radio, unless they were doing a mix or they were doing the top five at five or whatever the hell, you know, you would hear the same thing. And then most likely they had just played like the top song, because it's the top song. It's going to be the top song because they kept playing it throughout the whole day. So at the top song at number five, I mean, at 5 o'clock, number one is going to be the one that they played over and over, because of course, you know, they're saying people are asking for it. It's not really that true.
Right. And we got to remember, man, hip hop is such a different genre than any other sound we've ever heard on earth, because, you know, it's kind of like, I like to call it the soccer of the music industry, because no matter how poor you are in the world, if you could just get a soccer ball, or something that looks like a soccer ball, you can play soccer. You know what I mean? And that's why, like, in the United States, soccer isn't the most popular thing in the world, but the rest of the world really appreciates football, soccer, you know what I'm saying? Because It doesn't cost much to go get a ball and kick it around. So same with hip hop. You didn't need to know how to play a guitar or play the organ to drop a song. You just needed to be creative. You needed to have your own sound, your own rhyme scheme, your own persona. You know, you touched bases on beatboxers. You know, today I can't even imagine having 20 people show up to a beatbox battle. You know what I'm saying? Like, but back then, you know, everything was so organic that people was just at parties having a good time and beatboxing, and everybody was feeling that groove, that vibe.
I would say in beatbox defense, because I still watch a lot of beatboxing, and it's mostly out in Sweden and stuff like that. They still have hip hop battles, beatbox battles, battles with the loop stations and stuff like that. So I mean, it's gone away here locally, but like when you hear it, you like it and you want it back, but it's just not a common thing here. So like, if you were to watch like, not The Voice, but what is it? What's the other show? America's Got Talent, and you'll get some of those guys that spill over from the beatbox battle. I think it's called RBX, you know, out in England and stuff like that. I think it's England or Switzerland. They still do the beatbox battles, and some of those guys, you know, will come to shows and actually win the shows, you know, just with beatboxing, and they still have the battles. But here in the United States, that's kind of played out. I guess you can say it's played out, or people not practicing it as much unless you go into like the New York train station or something like that, somewhere where somebody's just, you know, doing it for entertainment and stuff like that.
That's a very valid point. And I think touching base on what you're saying is people are digesting music differently now than we used to back then. Because back then we didn't have Apple Music, Spotify. We couldn't just go look up a random artist that we love and say, I want to hear this all day. Like, you had right. to go to the CD shop, the tape shop, you know, you had to go to a record store and buy these records, and they were all over the place, you know. And now it's hard to find a record store, you know, it's like a hidden jewel. So now let's say you missed out on Slick Rick. You don't know who Slick Rick is. There's nothing out here that you're going to run into that's going to say, oh, yo, like, check out this Slick Rick album from 1985. Like, you kind of have to know music in order to go in there into this big database of music and find what you want to listen to. Because, you know, sounds evolve, the music evolves, that's fine. But what's not fine is when you're trying to set precedents and leave history, and you're leaving out bits and pieces of the history that make a big difference in the big grand scheme of things. So like you said, beatboxing is kind of died down here in the States. They still got underground battles where people will freestyle battle each other, right? But here's the problem I have with the battle leagues is that it's scripted. At the end of the day, these people aren't going on stage and freestyling off the top of their head with their natural ability and their poetic prowess. They're just going out there, they're writing stuff down, they doing research on their opponent, and then they just come out with the most ruthless, hardcore, aggressive thing that they can come up with. And it's like, that's cool. Like, it's still cool to watch the battles, I ain't gonna lie. Like I will watch Arsenal and Loaded Lux go at it, or Murder Mook or something. But at the end of the day, it's still scripted. It's not something that these guys are just spitting off the top of their head. It's not organic anymore.
I disagree. And the reason I disagree is not about what you said, is how you said it. Because you got to think, when you play football, whether it be soccer or American football or baseball or boxing, you know, any sport, what do they do before the game or prior to the game? They watch, you know, the tape on their opponents. I'm not going to say enemies, on their opponents, and they kind of see how they play and what do they do at certain points in time, or, you know, how they retaliate, but how they counter, you know, because you don't want to go into a rap battle beatboxing the way you beatbox the time you did before, because that person is looking at you and listening the way you did it and is going to try to one up you. So it's in your best interest to do the same thing. You're going to one up them, you know, so you're going to listen and see, you know, what's the best, you know, rhythm to come out to. And I wouldn't say scripted, it's practice to a certain point, because they need to do, they got to, like I said, they have to one up you. You know, you don't want to go doing the same beatbox as them, you know, because now you just played yourself. Because if that was your whole routine, you know, what they just did or part of the routine is going to sound the same, and you're not going to woo the crowd, you know, to like you. They're going to actually go with the first person who did it. That's just like, there's still, you know, dance battles. There's still, it's just everything, you know, well, breakdance battles, b-boy battles, you know, it's just, they keep one, you know, you would think at this point, everybody's done this, that dance already, but there's still a bunch of other dancers. They figure out what's the hardest thing they can do, you know, without hurting themselves to woo the crowd. So that's my take on that.
Okay. So yes, in sports, you know, you do your training, you do your, you know, you watch your film. I understand that part. But as a purist, like as a hip hop purist, you know, when it was a freestyle battle, it's off the top of the head. And so it's kind of hard to replicate something that you are doing off the top of your head over and over again.
So let me just interject real quick. It is off the top of your head, but not everything. Most lyricists already have something preset to what they're going to say. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not a rapper, so I'm not going to say, you know, I know everything, but there's some already preset, or they've said it before. So it's not, I can't really say it's 100% off the top of the dome. You know, I'd say it's about 70%, because it's something they said before, or something in an old rap that they've said, they just bring it back, change it around, you know, because it has to rhyme. You can't go off the top of your head for a long period of time without reverting back to something you said before.
That's true.
That's what I'm thinking.
I think that people also like to have authentic moments, though. Like some of the best, you know, disses or some of the best moments in hip hop have been spontaneous. You know, like there was a battle in the 80s where you had one MC go on stage and he tried to rock the crowd, and he was rocking the crowd. He did a great job. And I just forgot his name right now, but Biz Markie hops on stage and he does his signature dance. You know what I'm saying? He starts dancing on stage and he rocked the club so bad, like so good. Like everybody loved it, like to where he won the battle without even spitting a rhyme. That is crazy. You know what I'm saying? But I understand what you're saying about it's kind of preset, but that goes into training and practice and rehearsal. You know what I'm saying? So for example, like,
so like you said, scripted?
No, there's a big difference. There's a big difference. There's a difference between me. Like I got notes on my phone with all my lyrics, right? It's my whole note section is full of lyrics. If I pull up one of my random notes and I start spitting, that is scripted. And I can memorize this by heart to where, look, like I got a song from January 18, 2017. I could still spit it right now the same way I wrote it in 2017, even if I haven't said the words since then. So scripted, what I mean is they will pre-write what they're going to say, and then they say it. There's a difference with that and I'm standing in the mirror, or I'm in my car, or I'm out in public, and I'm just rapping about whatever comes to my mind. So, you know, there's a rapper. If you go on YouTube, you can look him up, and he's an old school guy. He's not rapping now. His name at the time was Supernat. Well, they call him Supernatural, but it was short Supernat. And Supernat, you can go watch him. He would literally freestyle off the top of his head about anything. So a person would go and say, all right, rap about this. And he just go with the flow and just do his own thing. That is different. And so when I'm saying, the closest thing that I guess we can give our audience to what a freestyle battle should look like or kind of look like is 8 Mile. So you go back and you watch 8 Mile. And you see the three freestyle battles that they had on stage, right? The first battle, Eminem loses. And then, you know, the next three battles, he wins. But when they drop the Mobb Deep beat, you know, at the very end, the Shook Ones, they drop Shook Ones, the instrumental. What does Eminem do? He looks over. He starts vibing because the other guy had just, he thought he won the battle. He thought he's like, I got this. Eminem lets the beat ride a little bit. He gets the audience going, and he says, now everybody from the 313, put your motherfucking hands up and follow me. And then he says, now notice he stands tough. Notice that this man did not have his hands up. Like, that's how a freestyle battle should go. It's you're looking at your opponent directly in front of you, and you're going at it. You're trying to rock the crowd while destroying your opponent at the same time. So when I see these battles that are like Underground Battle League or any of these battle leagues, I'm not trying to come at anybody. You know, I'm not knocking the hustle. But what I'm saying is just like, it's not pure, you know. And
those are more scripted. I'd say those right there.
But that's what we're talking about, is there's a difference with writing something, memorizing it, and then going on stage and saying it's a freestyle. Or how many times have we had artists go on the radio nowadays, especially? And they're like, all right, yo, so we're going to drop this freestyle. And then they play the beat, and the artist automatically just catches the beat, got the dopest rhyme. Every word rhymes. They don't have no, they don't stutter, nothing. That's not natural. That's not your talent. That means, I mean, it's not that you didn't write it. It's not that you're not gifted. It's just the fact that you can't do it off the top of your head. And that's what bothers me is, if you're invested in your craft, if you're an artist, you got to be obsessed with it. You got to be to the point where people think you're crazy, you know, because I would walk around high school with my headphones on and I didn't give a damn who heard me, who didn't hear me, whether I was good or whack. And I'm spitting my heart out, you know what I'm saying? And you got to build up your confidence. So, yeah, like if you ask me right now, all right, Ray, drop a freestyle, I'll give you a good 20, 30 Maybe a minute of a solid. That's the Wii sound. Yeah. Okay. I ain't gonna drop no damn freestyle. No, cause I would drop a freestyle if I knew that the placement was gonna be right with the sound. But I don't want to sound off beat on the freestyle. But on the real
though, yeah, you gotta blame that on me too.
Hey, if you the editor, you know what I'm saying? You know, I gotta get me a new engineer. But
I don't know. I may have did something, but so I don't think so.
Let's keep it pushing, because I think I did dwell a little bit too much on this organic writing versus not. You know, but the whole industry itself, what I'm getting at about this whole topic is that the music industry is a member of the media, because there's only three ways that the media can communicate with the public. It's through the radio, through TV, and now the internet. Those are the three ways. Yeah. There's really no other way for them to be able to have their input and voice in your ear. So when we're talking about stuff like this, it's just more of like, look, man, hip hop is not what it used to be. Hip hop used to be very informative. It was a place where people went and learned the game, learned life from different parts of the world and backgrounds and financial situations. You know, I'll give you a story, Morph. I don't know if you know this. Did you know that Ice Cube grew up like well off? Like Ice Cube wasn't a gangster. He was never a gang member. He never got arrested. But
I knew parts of that story because I knew that was the whole hiccup between him and NWA, because everyone in NWA was, you know, part of the whole gangster scene, and Ice Cube really wasn't. So that's why he didn't fit in, and they, you know, they basically were calling him a fake. And that's when he basically went on his own and stole their beats.
But man, he had a lot of controversy because he also had beef with Cypress Hill. And if you go Cypress Hill is like a hidden gem, because I didn't even appreciate them until I went back and heard, and oh man, they good too. But he got a lot of stuff from them. They got a lot of stuff from him. They had that controversy, but the way the stuff was done in the East Coast was different than how it was done on the West Coast. And it was different as to how it was done in the South. So people that talk about East Coast, West Coast, they always talk about Bad Boy, Death Row. People forget that down South, we had Rap-A-Lot Records. We didn't just have Rap-A-Lot Records. We also had Master P with the No Limit Records. You know, so it wasn't just East and West. There was a lot of power. There were a lot of power heads, gatekeepers. These guys were the guys that said, who's going to make it, who's not going to make it. For example, remember, who was the first artist signed to Bad Boy?
Notorious.
Craig Mack.
No, it was Notorious.
And then it was Notorious. What did they do? Craig Mack dropped his song, Flavor in Your Ear.
And did a big remix with everybody and their mama from.
And then they did the remix with Biggie. Biggie didn't even want to hop on the song because, you know, I guess him and Craig Mack had like a different vibe. And Craig Mack ended up retiring. He became a Christian and he stopped doing music. He passed away a few years ago, unfortunately. But that's the point, is like, it wasn't just one thing, you know? So like, to say that Bad Boy represented the East Coast and to say that Death Row represented West Coast and that was it? No, because Nas wasn't signed to Bad Boy. Wu-Tang wasn't signed to Bad Boy. KRS-One wasn't signed to Bad Boy.
We had this conversation earlier. So what I was telling Ray was he's 100% correct. They're not the only one. So Bad Boy and Death Row is not the only ones. They were just the common ones, you know, the ones that were making, had the most artists on there and was able to, you know, do the remixes with other people, you know, collaborate in pop and do what other labels couldn't, because the label that, you know, let's say Murder Inc., right? Murder Inc. was big at that time too, but they wasn't making enough noise because it was Ashanti really wasn't doing much. It was just Ja Rule, you know, and what, Soleil? Something like that. But they wasn't as big and as mainstream as, you know, a Dr. Dre was, a Snoop Dogg, you know, just having the two record owners, the record label owners like Suge Knight, you know, making his own news, you know, and then P. Diddy making his own news, you know, that's what made him stand out. You know, you didn't hear, you know, Clive, you know, all on everybody's records. He was just collecting the trophies and the money. So that's the biggest difference between the two of them. And that's what me and Ray were talking about. So speaking on the East Coast, West Coast thing, you know, part of that Dark Side of the 90s talked about two of the guys that were best friends at one point, Tupac and Biggie, and how they kind of, you know, parted ways. And the initial From what I remember, and the same as the documentary stated, initially when Tupac got shot outside of the studio, that's what started the whole, you know, rift between the two of them, just because, you know, the whole time he was thinking Notorious actually set that up just because he happened to be in the studio the same day, you know. So go ahead, Ray. You look like you want to say something.
So I'll give our audience a little backstory on the Quad Studio shooting. It was the first time Tupac had got shot. From watching interviews and documentaries for a long time, Tupac, I guess it was like Tupac took it like, Big, you my guy. If you come out to LA, I'ma take care of you. I'ma protect you. Like, we boys. You gonna look out for me, I'ma look out for you. What Tupac took offense to was that he knew that Big, Puff, everybody was up there recording, because he had ran into, I think it was Lil C's from Junior Mafia. He had ran into him downstairs or whatever, and they was like, yo, you know, we upstairs, we recording, yada, yada, yada. So when Tupac got approached by the two robbers, or the two shooters, you know, Tupac was shocked, because he was like, what you mean? Y'all trying to rob me? You know, and next thing you know, boom, he gets shot, and it's controversy. And Tupac just, look, if you haven't been shot, I haven't been shot. I've been shot at, but I ain't been shot. You know, so if you haven't been shot and took the bullets that Tupac took, you don't understand the psychological effect that could have on you. Because, I mean, he got shot in a testicle, I think. He got shot in multiple places, you know. And when you get hurt that bad, and you in your own hometown, because he's from New York, and that's something that also upset me about the Dark Side of the 90s. It was like they made it sound like Tupac wasn't even from New York. They never once said Tupac was from New York. Like, nope. Tupac and Big were from New York. Big used to sleep.
They kept saying West Coast rapper Tupac.
Exactly. Tupac moved to Cali, but he's from New York. He was already rapping in New York before he moved to Cali, because he went to the School of Baltimore Arts, where he met Jada Pinkett Smith, and they were best friends at the time. So Tupac was definitely an East Coast artist that just relocated to the West Coast. It wasn't even his choice. His mom moved out there, you know what I'm saying? So for them to say that it was a beef between two artists from two different coasts, that is where I feel like they stretched the truth and made it a lie. Because the beef was never about, well, New York's better than L.A. or L.A.'s better than New York. But the issue was money. Suge Knight was generating a lot of money from the West Coast, when at the time it was an East Coast thing. You know, like, East Coast was the one dominating the market. So if you got Puffy making all this money, and you got, you know, all these other, you know, like you said, Murder, Inc., they had Def Jam at some point. That's the East Coast. They all making that money. There's going to be a power struggle. So in that power struggle, we had Suge Knight, we had P. Diddy, we had Jay Prince down here in Houston, we had Master P with No Limit. Because if you remember, Snoop Dogg ended up leaving Death Row Records, and where did he sign? No Limit Records. No Limit Records.
Two albums or something.
And exactly my point. And then not only that, but then after that, you got Cash Money Records coming up, Birdman, Lil Wayne, late 90s. So it was all about a money grab at that point. And I think with Suge Knight being the gangster that he was, Puffy wasn't a gangster. You know, P. Diddy was never a gangster. He was a marketing genius. Like, I think P. Diddy was ahead of his time. Do I agree with all his business practices? No. Did I agree with all of Suge Knight's business practices? No. But at the end of the day, at the time, these two were the cash cows.
The difference between the two was P. Diddy knew how to market his artists and get them on the radio, because he already had like connections within the industry. And that's why he was no longer with Interscope? No, Atlantic. Who was he with?
No, I think it was, I don't know if it was Arista. He had a deal with somebody and it fell through. And then that's why he went and did his own thing with Bad Boy. Or it could have been Warner Brothers for all I know.
No, I think it may have been Arista. It's one of those. It's one of those big companies, Interscope. I don't know, one of those. And they got rid of him for, I guess, certain practices or something. And then he started his own label. But the difference between him and Suge Knight would go to, you know, interviews and record labels and different DJs and force them to play the stuff. I mean, if you want to really get into the history, you know, just look at, you know, some of the things with Death Row Records, him hanging people upside down, mm-hmm. you know, out of windows, and Vanilla Ice. I know he felt it. Now that's why he changed his tune as a so-called gangster rapper from, what did he say? He said he was from Florida and he wasn't, and all this other stuff. But the other issue was, and we needed to get into this, is Vibe magazine, you know, started by
Quincy Jones.
So he started Vibe magazine and the Source magazine. They kind of were going at it, you know, the Source being a more independent type newspaper that had like
quote unquote
no kind of like yeah they didn't have no well they didn't have no funding no major funding. And then when Quincy Jones came out with his stuff, it was like full pictured articles, advertisement, you know. And he basically started focusing on all the West Coast rappers. And a lot of people are like throwing Vibe under there and saying, you know, they pretty much, you know, fueled the fire between the East Coast, West Coast, because they kept putting like Snoop Dogg in there, Death Row Records. And I mean, there's more cover albums with West Coast rappers than any East Coast rappers. Whereas the Source would do a little bit of everything. They wouldn't just stick to, I mean, yeah, they were biased and had more East Coast people in there, but not as bad as Vibe. And then Vibe kind of would put these articles out there, you know, that kind of pointed the fingers at Puffy and other things, you know, that was going on. And then, I mean, so Biggie and Tupac is another thing. So Biggie is killed. Well, Tupac is killed after the Tyson fight, where if you look at the reports, because I read the book many years ago, but reading the book and seeing it on YouTube is totally different. So Tupac was heading to the 662 Club, which was Suge Knight's club, and some of the South Side Crips were going to meet him there to kill him. So they went there and they didn't see him. So they turned around and started heading the other way. And Tupac was hanging outside of the sunroof or moonroof, whatever you want to call it. And like talking to girls and they were like, Tupac, Tupac. And he was with his hands up, you know, and that's when the Southside Crips saw him, which one of them at that, I missed this part. It at the Las Vegas Strip, well, at the casino, got beat down. His name was Orlando Brown, which is the actual shooter of Tupac. I'll just spoil it right there. So he was the one. Originally, someone told Tupac that he's the one that stole his Death Row chain at a, I forgot what it was, a concert or something. So they stomped him like pretty bad. And he came back with the Southside Crips in that white Cadillac, and he was the shooter. So I think you told me this. And when I went back to like, look at it, sure enough, that dude went and snitched on everybody, cause he was sitting in the back. But he didn't say he was a shooter, and he didn't say that Orlando Brown was the one sitting next to him, but the driver was the one that got the 40 caliber pistol and gave it to Orlando Brown, and he killed Tupac, right? So he kills Tupac, and so his ties, he's tied to the Southside Crips, which the Southside Crips, the guy named Keefe, I think that's the name, he's tied to Puff Daddy. You know, so Puff Daddy was, you know, mixing around with the Crips. And then Puff Daddy, you know, at that time had a hit on him, supposedly by Suge Knight. So I know I'm this is like a little spider web or like Jada or Will would say an entanglement.
Yeah.
So then Biggie gets killed 6 months later. And Biggie was leaving, what was it, Soul Train Awards?
Yep.
And, I mean, both of these folks, both of these guys had had guards with them, but they were in different vehicles. His vehicle gets shot up by the Bloods. Those Bloods are the same Bloods that deal with Suge Knight, you know, and originally the police officer that investigated all of this, you know, the reason why they did such a big investigation on all of this was because they were blaming it on the LAPD being part of it. And the reason why they said the LAPD was being, it was took a hand in this was because Suge Knight actually had paid police officers on his payroll that actually were working for him and were crooked and corrupt. So they would steal drugs that were seized through like drug busts and bring them back to him. And, you know, he would pay them. So they were basically paid police thugs and stuff like that. But going back to the story. So what was his name? Pookie Perucci or something like that was the name of the guy that killed Biggie. The gunman, but they don't know if he was by himself or not, which the crazy part is each of those guys died. So Orlando Brown ended up dying like a few years after killing Tupac.
He got murdered
because he got into a gun battle with somebody who owed him money, supposedly, you know, but it sounded like it was a hit against him. Same as Peruki or Pookie. I can't remember his name.
To be honest,
Pikachu, I don't know.
I don't know about Biggie's killer. From what I understand, that whole situation was a little suspect because, as you mentioned, Biggie always had security with him, and that one night he just didn't have security with him. Like, his security was dispatched and sent somewhere else, and he got lit up. So that is not accidental. I mean, unless you want to suck on your thumb and think the clouds are made out of marshmallows, you know, then yeah, believe that story. But when you have that much money and you have that much reputation and stuff, people are going to test you all the time. And not only did Orlando,
crazy part is his vehicle actually had stickers that said Big. So, I mean, he was like a rolling target. You know, Tupac made himself a rolling target because he was out of the window. And the Crips actually said that if he wasn't outside of the window, they wouldn't have even known it was him because they were passing each other up. And they ended up turning around when they saw him out the window. But the guy that was a Blood, he was actually paid by Suge Knight originally to do the hit on P. Diddy.
So here's
from the reports I saw.
I want to give you a little backstory that I heard, and this is just alleged. You know, I don't know if this information is correct or not. I wasn't there, but from what I hear, you know, Biggie went out to Cali, and Biggie did a radio interview a couple days before the Source Awards, or maybe like a week before the Source Awards, and I think Tupac had been killed, and so this was Biggie's first time back in Cali since that had happened. And when he gave the radio interview, instead of Biggie going to Cali and showing like sympathy or empathy or anything for what happened, he was very almost nonchalant about Tupac being murdered. You know, like he said, you know, the infamous line, like, I wouldn't wish, you know, harm on nobody because it'll come back on you. But like he basically saying, like, you know, I'm moving forward. I'm coming out here. I'm in Cali. I'm doing my thing. We pushing this music video. We pushing this. We pushing that. So I think that from what I heard, that really offended and pissed off the West Coast, because again, you just came into their territory after their guy just got killed. You know, Tupac was that guy. You know, not only was he a rapper, but he was an actor. He had done Poetic Justice. He had done the movie where he ended up, Menace to Society, where he beat up the producers.
Menace to Society.
You know, and then the last movie he did, which I forget the name, but it was it Gridlocked? It was a pretty good movie.
Yeah, I think it was Gridlocked.
It was a pretty good movie. So Tupac was really out there, you know. So for Big to go to the West Coast and not have that love and say, like, you know, man, like, I never would have thought things would have blew out of this proportion or something. You know, I think that's why it became easier at that point to go ahead and, you know, knock that domino over, which was Biggie, because the West Coast was hurting. You know, the same way the West Coast was hurting recently when Nipsey Hussle unfortunately got killed, it was worse when Tupac got killed. It hurt even more. Man, I can only imagine being there at the time. I mean, I was way too young when Tupac died. I was like 5. But, you know, I remember when Kobe died. Like last in 2020, I came home and my girl tells me, hey, babe, Kobe died. And I'm like, man, girl, get out of here. Shut up. You know, like you probably clicked on one of those clickbait articles on Facebook or something. Kobe ain't. I would have been found out if Kobe died. I would have found out somehow. Twitter, SportsCenter, somehow. Man, when I went and looked it up and saw that Kobe died, my stomach dropped. I wasn't even a Kobe fan, like, because Kobe, I'm a Houston Rockets fan, and you know, the Lakers always beat the crap out the Rockets. But I always respected Kobe in the sense of, like, well, you got to be that damn good to be hated, you know? And so when he died, it just hurt. So I could just imagine the pain that the West Coast felt when Tupac got murdered. And he got killed in Vegas. He didn't even get killed in New York. So that's why I get mad when they say East versus West. That wasn't the thing, man. It was dudes with money fighting over who's going to get this bigger chunk of the pie.
Because, yeah, it was a hype. It was more of a hype, you know, just to make the music bigger and better. But it wasn't so much an East Coast, West Coast. I mean, there was animosity between them, but not as much to kill each other. It's like gang members that are wannabes. They want to do something to like be known as the bigger and better person, just like the guy Orlando Brown, right? So they kept saying he killed, you know, Tupac, and he kept saying it wasn't him. He didn't want to be known as the person that killed Tupac, you know, and this and that. And then everybody in his family is like, oh no, he didn't do it. He wouldn't do it. He would never do anything like that. And then the guy that snitched him out was like his own, what was it, his uncle or something?
His cousin.
It was his own relative that, you know, and then he comes on screen and says, well, you know, gangster's code. I'm not going to say, but it was two people sitting in the back. Okay, you just said it. If one person is sitting back there and he say he didn't have a gun, and the one that just got beat up like 10 minutes before this whole thing happened, of course, he's still pissed. You know, he hasn't gotten over it. Give that guy a gun, and now you're looking for somebody. You know, somebody tipped you off that they're going to be at the 662 Club, you know. And look, Suge Knight didn't get shot. All them shots that went in that car, how is it that Suge Knight didn't get shot? Well, they say that Tupac
did get grazed.
But you're sitting point blank next to a car and they're shooting. If you look at the car, it's like riddled with bullets and it's going right through the car. but they were shooting into it, and they, at one point they say he was standing up and doing it, like he got out the car, and then the other one they're saying that he just like shot through the window. But I mean, Tupac even laid down, you know, laid back to kind of get away from the bullets, and Suge Knight still didn't get hit. Why?
I think it's safe to assume that
Suge, he's 2 feet from him, and he's a bigger target.
Yeah, but if Tupac's the one that caught the bullets, I mean, the bullets is only going to go in one direction. Like, you know what I'm saying? Suge wasn't the target at the end of the day. Like, and another thing is, you look, everything has to be put into context, because there's Tupac before he went to jail, then there's Tupac after he got out of jail. There's Tupac before the rape case, and then there's Tupac after. There's Tupac before he shot the undercover cops, and then the, you know, Tupac was such a complex person. Like, he's got Keep Your Head Up, and Brenda's Got a Baby, and he's got all these classic, you know, good feel songs, and then he also has songs like Thug Love with Bone mm-hmm. Thugs and Harmony. Then he's got songs, you know, Hit 'Em Up, you know, and Tupac got out of jail with a mission, and he said it. He said it every fucking time he got a chance. You know, I'm coming for y'all. All y'all that saw me sitting in jail, I'm coming for y'all. Because nobody talks about the stuff that got done to Tupac when he was in prison. You know what I'm saying? Every time Tupac had a visitor in prison, he got cavity searched, which means they stripped him butt naked. They had to put on a glove. They checked his rectum every time. And
they wrecked them for real.
And they wrecked them for real. And they had Tupac on like 23-hour lockdown. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. So the fact is that they basically were torturing Tupac in prison. And then not only that, they telling them in prison, hey, yo, I heard that such and such did such and such and said such and such. So Tupac got out of jail with a mission, like, oh, nah, I'm coming. I'm going to get y'all. The only reason Tupac even signed to Death Row Records was because Suge Knight paid him his bail. Suge Knight literally went to jail with a handwritten letter. Tupac signed it, and Tupac was free because it was like $1 million something bail, bond, whatever. I don't know. And now, as we mentioned with School Yonder last week, when you sign that contract, there's obligations. And Tupac still had to drop records and albums. And so when Tupac gets out of jail,
especially if you sign on Death Row, obligations.
When Tupac gets out of jail, what's the first record that they put out? You remember?
What's the song?
I'll give you a clue. It was with him and Dr. Dre.
Yeah, it's the Rain one. I can't remember what it was.
California Love, buddy.
No, I don't think it was that one.
It was the first. So Dr. Dre already has California Love done. Like, he had already written the hook, he already had the beat. It was his song. Suge Knight, so excited that he got Tupac to sign, makes Dre put Tupac on the album, on the song, and that became California Love. Tupac was never a part of California Love. He just came out, and that song was basically gifted to him, like, all right, let's do this. And so then you got they dropped the California Love video, and they got Dre and Tupac, and it was the biggest thing because Dre was already Dre, Tupac was already Tupac, and now they all together under Death Row. And then we knew eventually they did the song with him and Snoop, America's Most Wanted. Yeah. Tupac and Snoop. So they knew what they were doing. Tupac wasn't coming for the West, for the East Coast specifically. He never once said fuck New York or fuck Jersey or fuck Philly. That never came out of Tupac's mouth. What came out of Tupac's mouth was fuck your bitch and the click you claim. I'm coming for P. Diddy, anybody affiliated with P. Diddy. Tupac charged up Nas. You know what I'm saying? And they didn't go any further than that. But Tupac was also trying to do Death Row East? And he was going to do a collab project with like Rakim and all these West Coast and East Coast artists together. So when they say East Coast versus West Coast beef, I get irritated each time, because to me it's like, it's just money at the end of the day. Because we've mentioned so many people, and we got to break these people down at some point. Not today, but, you know, Quincy Jones. If you don't know who Quincy Jones is and his backstory, Quincy Jones is the producer that produced the Thriller album for Michael Jackson, which is the highest selling album of all time. So imagine you're the producer. You're not the artist. You're not the writer. You're the producer. You're the guy that put it all together. You got the bigger chunk out of that money than anybody else. So Quincy Jones had a lot of money. So when we say the source was an independent, yeah, independent in the sense of they didn't have all the money Quincy Jones had, but they already had the market. So Quincy Jones goes and offers the source. He offers them $600,000 to buy the company, and they took that personal. They're like, hell no. So he goes and he starts the vibe.
Well, first,
stick the middle finger up the source.
First he said he was going to make his own magazine and buy them out. So basically not just make a magazine and they compete against each other. Is I want to make a magazine, but buy y'all out, like get rid of y'all ass, you know, and you know, just move along. And I guess they didn't like it. I wish the other guy, Sector, would have did the interview. I don't know where he was. They didn't show him. And I know that, was it Maze? The main guy, one of the main guys that did the interview, he's no longer with the newspaper either. So I don't know who's doing the source now.
Yeah. I mean, but even then it's not, the source ain't what it was. Vibe ain't what it was, you know? And what I will say is, like, with Vibe, they started doing the interviews and recording the interviews. So you could go back and watch Tupac's Vibe interview. Because they did it on the magazine. They had the story in the magazine where Tupac was saying everything. But then they also got the footage of Tupac talking and saying what he had to say. And ultimately, man, I think that there wasn't enough room for there to be two elephants in the room. There could only be room for one. And at the end of the day, hip-hop unanimously, I mean, they didn't decide to get rid of both of them. But if one elephant got taken out, the other elephant got to go too. But at the end of the day, this is a multi-level battle, and it wasn't East versus West. It was all about the Benjamins. So at the end of the day, when you got
who was making the most money?
Suge Knight, P. Diddy. Then you got Quincy Jones. You got the people from the source. This is so multi-level, so multifaceted that to where it's very easy to say in the media, oh, East versus West. And then you play an East Coast song and it's saying da-da-da-da-da, and you play a West Coast song and da-da-da-da. Rap itself is competitive in nature. It's never been a friendly sport. Like, you know how, you know, now if you lose, there's no such thing as a loser. Everybody gets a trophy. That wasn't the case with hip hop. If you were whack, you were whack. You got booed off stage. They beat you up. Mm-hmm. They, you know, whatever. So you got an artist like Biggie to where he drops Ready to Die. And Gangsta, classic, lyrical album, one of the top best albums of all time. And then you got Tupac with Me Against the World and all these other albums. Eventually he dropped the Don Caluminati, the 7-Day Theory, right before he passed. And then they released that when he died. But basically, man, like I'm saying, there's so much money involved that, you know, you got Biggie doing Juicy. That's Puffy being brilliant. Let me put Biggie on a Juicy, on a record called Juicy, and the hook is catchy, and the females is gonna like it, and it's gonna bring, like, Biggie was like the first Lizzo. You know what I'm saying? Like, Biggie is like the first big fat.
Except not naked.
Exactly. The first big fat dude to be cool, to dress fresh, to make people want to be like, well, damn, that big dude got some character, some swagger, he know how to dress. Biggie, and then let's not forget that big old mansion that Biggie had in the video, that big old white, it looked like the White House, big old mansion that they threw. So two completely different artists. Tupac was so poetic, lyrical in his own right. You know, if I had to pick between the two, like, I used to always pick Tupac, you know, but now, like, lyrically, I mean, Biggie got it. You know what I'm saying? Biggie got it lyrically. Biggie got it in every way, shape, and form. But that doesn't take away from Tupac's greatness, and it doesn't take away from how lyrical he was, because they were painting two different pictures. Same.
Yeah, can you imagine if they were still around now? I mean, they were, what, 24, 25 when they got killed?
Yeah.
I mean, and that was what year was that? 2006?
What?
2007?
What?
When they got killed.
No, they got killed in 95 and 96. No, 96, 97.
96, that's what I'm thinking. I'm trying to remember the years. Yeah. I mean, so can you imagine? I mean, now it would have been, what, 15 years? No.
Nah, it'd be a good 20. They'd be about 40. They'd be in their 50s right now, early 50s right now. So, yeah. You know, and it's tragic because, look, but see, that's the thing too, man. These guys were talking about dying. It's like, it's in a way, it's like they had a death wish, you know, because Biggie's first album, Ready to Die. Really? Like, you know, and then you got, you know, Tupac with the 7-day theory and Hail Mary and I ain't a killer, but don't push me. And like, these guys were evolving right before our eyes. Like, at the end of the day, like, we look at these like grown men, but they were kids, man. 24, 25, they was kids. Biggie had,
they both be about 50, like you said.
Biggie had children, you know what I'm saying? Tupac, you know, and some people don't even know this. Tupac was briefly married, you know what I'm saying, to Quincy Jones's daughter, Kadada Jones. So
yeah, which he actually knew something was gonna go down because he actually told her to stay home because she was supposed to be with him at that.
Yes, she was supposed to go to Vegas, and then she changed the plans at the last second, and Tupac ended up going to Vegas. So, but that's the thing. See, Quincy Jones pops up in the picture again. And if you go back and watch Tupac interviews, if y'all don't believe me about this gay stuff, Tupac himself, he came at Dr. Dre. He came at Quincy Jones. He came at Arsenio Hall, at Eddie Murphy. Tupac was calling out people in the industry on their ghosts in the closet. And at the time, that was not acceptable. It was not appropriate. It was almost like a code. So the same way, you know, we got Blue Lives Matter today, or like the Blue Shield or whatever, the same way they had codes back then. And even to this day, man, there's a lot of artists in the industry that are probably gay or whatever, but they keep that to themselves because they want to maintain a certain image or they want to maintain their fan base. But nowadays, it almost looks like if you're not gay, something's wrong with you. You know, like that's how they make it look in the media. Like,
that's because everything's thrown at you now. Not before, it used to be hidden. You know, to be in the closet was like the way to be. So like that, your career could carry on. Now it's, if you are gay, bring it out to the front, you know, don't hide it. Because then if you do find out, if eventually someone finds out, it could be worse, you know.
I'll tell you, the last person to break my heart, and I'm not going to say break my heart like in a bad way. I'm saying it like I was shocked, was Tyler, the Creator. So, you know, I know he's kind of like a niche artist. Like you kind of have to be into that sound to really like Tyler, the Creator. But when Tyler, the Creator first comes out, he's talking that hardcore, you know, he's saying the F word, you know, not fuck, but the other F word. And he's saying a bunch of things. And then next thing you know, he drops this album in 2017, 2018 called Flower Boy or whatever. I forget the whole name of the album. And he comes out the closet and he's like, okay, well, I've been gay this whole time. And yeah, I said the F word and I said all that, but that was just me making fun of it. Like I was trying to use it the same way we use the N word. Like, no, bro, like you can't, it's deceiving. Like, I don't have a problem with anybody being who they are. If you're gay, straight, transgender, whatever you are, be what you are, but be that at all times. Don't sit here and reel me in and try to make me a part of your lifestyle or your life, and then all of a sudden flip on me and be like, oh, nah, well, this is what I really am. Because I feel like you're lying to me. So it has nothing to do with your sexuality or gender, whatever. That's your problem. Whatever you do, that's what you do. But You know, how many years do we hear about Eminem being gay? You know, cross-dressing and stuff. We heard stories about Dr. Dre cross-dressing and having sex in studios with men and women. And at the end of the day, those things were all taboo back then. Now, there's a term for all that. It's called polyamorous. You can love multiple people. Or there's the cisgenders where you could love anything. Like, you could be non-binary. You could be a straight male and love and be with a lesbian female, or you could be a straight female and be with a gay guy or a bi guy or whatever. Like, they have broken the sexual barriers nowadays to where, like, you could do whatever you want. And in the industry, there's a famous saying, and it says, "Do what thou wilt." Okay, do what thou wilt. Jay-Z has a shirt. If you look up Jay-Z, he has a shirt that says "Do what thou wilt," and that comes from a satanic background. And the guy's name, his name is Aleister Crowley. So if you've never heard, or if you're curious as to why things are the way they are in the industry, look up a guy by the name of Aleister Crowley, and you will see what I'm talking about. He basically wrote the book on Satanism, and that's what they sit in here and they pump it in the industry all the time. And you don't have to.
Is that part of the Illuminati? Because they've been saying that Jay-Z is part of the Illuminati and
so
bringing Beyonce into it.
So look, man, oof. That right there is its own episode for real. Like, that is a whole other podcast episode. I don't like talking about the Illuminati so much because most people will write you off and say, "Oh, you are a conspiracy theorist. You're full of shit. You don't know what you're talking about." The Illuminati is a real thing, but that's not the main issue. Does that make sense? Like, you know, for example, people look at Masons and Illuminati as if they're the same thing. They may have similar symbols. Some Masons may be in the Illuminati, or some people in the Illuminati may want to be Masons, but that's just not the case. But yeah, when it comes down to Illuminati and stuff, that it's hard to prove. So it's kind of pointless to talk about it, because at the end of the day, there's always going to be another explanation for why something happened. But you know, even Tupac's last album, The Don Killuminati, that wasn't an accident. You know, Tupac flat out, he said, "I'm coming out here and I'm exposing everybody," because it's a secret. It's a secret society. Yeah. So you're not supposed to talk about it. So in my world, it makes sense that Tupac got killed, because he was talking reckless when he shouldn't have been talking reckless. You know, it's okay for Tupac to get on TV and talk about guns and thug life and all that. That's fine. But the minute Tupac started saying Dr. Dre was gay and Quincy Jones is gay and all this, that's when Tupac got killed. And that's just the facts. It's not that Tupac got killed because of that, but it doesn't help when you're putting a target on your back with multiple people or an entire industry all the time. I just feel like Big got killed. Big was like the sacrificial lamb. Like, all right, Big. You know, you're going to have to take this L, but that was it. You know, I don't see East Coast, West Coast at all.
All right. So that was our conversation today. East Coast, West Coast, Vibe magazine, and Source magazine, and the beginnings of hip hop, in the industry, and how Biggie and Tupac, you know, left us. So that's all we got this week. Thank you for tuning in. Make sure you check out our social medias. Be sure to hit us up on our website, www.morespeaks.com. And we are out of here.
Adios.
More Speaks.